Over NBC's Coast to Coast network of independent affiliated stations, the University of Chicago Roundtable. To open today's roundtable discussion of The Riddle of a Korean Ceasefire, we present Donald Locke, historian of the University of Chicago. Mr. Locke.
Is a military truce in Korea possible now? It was just 1 week ago the truce negotiations began in Korea between representatives of the United Nations forces and the representatives of the North Korean and Chinese forces. Difficulties have arisen over matters of procedure, but the talks have been resumed and are still going on. If a truce is concluded, what will it mean? Will it be lasting, or will it be violated in letter or spirit from the outset? What will such a truce mean in the terms of the tempo and conduct of the Cold War? Joining me in today's roundtable on the riddle of a Korean ceasefire are my colleagues at the University of Chicago, Quincy Wright, expert in problems of international law, and Louis Gottschalk, historian of revolutions. As an international lawyer, Wright, what are the prospects of the Korean ceasefire?
Lark, it seems to me that each side wants a ceasefire, but it wants it to appear that it won a victory. Gottschalk, it seems to me that the United Nations ought not to take this position. It ought to consider the problem solely of one of achieving its limited policing objectives, which is to drive the aggressor back to the 38th parallel, as stated in the United Nations resolutions of June 25th, a year ago.
Well, that question, right, of whether the Korean conflict is an international war or a United Nations police action is just what makes the possibility of an armistice seem to me to be a riddle. I think that most of the people of the United States, as well as Russia and China and Korea, think of this as a war and a war between equal forces, and therefore each side may be unwilling to make concessions, and consequently a truce may be hard to get at, and once gotten at, might be very hard to enforce.
Well, I can see that, Wright, you are optimistic about the possibilities of this truce being concluded. And Gottschalk, it seems to me that your attitude is essentially pessimistic.
Well, I don't want to be...
The University of Chicago Roundtable today, it seems to me, ought to approach this issue on the basis of four problems. Is a truce in the best interests of the United States? And what does a truce mean? And then what are China's motivations? What are the major diplomatic issues which will remain to be settled after the conclusion of such a truce? What do you think about approaching it in that way, Wright?
Well, I think that a truce will be signed. And I think so because I believe that it is in the interest of the United States, of the Chinese, and of the Russians. The question of whether it will be permanent is a question involving many military considerations. But I regard it as in the interest of the United States because I think the people want peace. And I think that the government doesn't want to have these hostilities going on which are diverting so large American forces to an area which they regard as not the major area in world strategy.
I agree, Wright, that the people of the United States want peace, and I think probably the people of China want peace, and certainly the people of Korea want peace. When you describe me as pessimistic, Locke, I don't want to be understood as being opposed to an armistice. What I am concerned about is that there are so many inherent difficulties that it does not appear to me easy to arrive first at an armistice and then secondly at an implementation of that armistice which will be lasting. And I expect many difficulties, even though I don't think that these difficulties are insurmountable.
Well, I agree that I think that the difficulties will certainly be great. And it seems to me that in talking about the advantages of a truce, as we have been, that we ought also to look at the other side of the picture, which is the question of the risks. I mean, will the conclusion of a truce in Korea, for instance, mean that we do not have our troops tied down any longer? It seems to me that we will continue to have troops tied down in Korea for a long time to come.
Well, that may be true, and there are other risks also. There is the risk, for instance, that if the Chinese stop fighting in Korea, they will start fighting in Indochina or Burma or somewhere else. And there's also the risk that if they stop fighting, it will give them an opportunity to regroup forces in large numbers and start fighting in Korea again. Those are risks which ought to be covered by the actual terms of the ceasefire agreement.
Well, in other words, Wright, we are making a very definite distinction here, are we not, between what a truce means and what peace negotiations mean. Now, as an international lawyer, what does a truce mean exactly?
Well, a truce is primarily a ceasefire. It is primarily military. However, international lawyers have made a distinction between local and temporary arrangements, which are often called suspensions of arms, and general armistices, which inherently have a certain political significance. For instance, a general armistice, such as that made with Germany in 1918, imply that there will be military lines which have a tendency to become political lines. And that, of course, is true here. And also is true that the disposition which is required of military forces in a general armistice tends to have a political effect. In other words, it tends to negotiate, to influence subsequent negotiations. So it has sometimes been the case that general armistices, which have been negotiated by commanders in the field, have been repudiated by the political authorities at home because the political authorities felt that they had political implications which were not desired.
Then you think that a truce does not necessarily lead to peace negotiations.
That it seems to me important to bear in mind that an armistice has complications all its own. Even when those are ironed out, you still have the problem of whether you can then sit around a conference table and through diplomatic means arrive at a peace conference. Now, it seems to me this armistice has particularly complicated problems, such as, for example, do you cease fire first while you carry on your armistice negotiations, or do you keep on fighting while the armistice negotiations are going on? And that has already raised complications.
Well, that's true, but the first point you were making as to the effect the armistice has on peace negotiations, it seems to me we should realize that it is possible to have a protracted ceasefire. That is, the truce may last for many years, even though no political settlement is made.
But you wouldn't go so far, right, as to say that we should unite Korea by military force, would you?
Well, that has been stated to be against the policy of the United Nations, that the objective of the United Nations from a political point of view is a free, independent, and united Korea. But the military objective has been stopping aggression at the 38th parallel.
Then, in other words, one of the probable outcomes of all this, provided there is any outcome at all, is likely to be that we will go right back to where we were before June 1950, and each side will be watching each other like cats, mice, and at any future time, the whole thing may start all over again.
Yes, true. I think that's very likely, and as a matter of fact, I think in assessing the possibilities of the success of this truce, we ought to think about the motivations of the Chinese government. We've already said something about the question of this truce being in the best interests of the United States, perhaps. Now, what would the motivations of China be, first in concluding this truce, and then after the conclusion of a truce, if we get such a conclusion?
I think that's fundamental. One has to ask, is the object of China to knock hostile forces, or forces hostile to her, out of Korea entirely, or were the objectives purely defensive, that is, to prevent United States and United Nations forces from advancing into Chinese territory and perhaps wiping out the Chinese Communist government?
Well,
one has to admit that the Chinese may genuinely think that the latter is the objective of the United States and the United Nations, and therefore that they are acting on the defensive.
Well, I agree.
You're an expert on China. You've just finished a big book on the international relations of China. What's your opinion on this?
Well, it seems to me that I agree essentially with Wright, that if I were a Chinese looking at this situation from inside of China with all of the propaganda machine of the Chinese communists at my disposal, I would be very much inclined to believe that the United States was embarking upon imperialist aggression. Historically, most of the attacks upon China, particularly those from Japan, have proceeded up the Korean Peninsula and have been aimed at Manchuria, which is one of the great economic bases of the Far East and certainly one of China's most important bases. Not only that, but this might look as an attack upon the very center of China's urban life, her great cities being located very close to Korea. Hence, when we hear in the newspaper and so on this talk about American aggression, I think we should not dismiss it very lightly as simply the mouthings of propagandists. I'm afraid that this is a kind of thing that is more generally believed in China and elsewhere than we normally think.
But you, both of you, it seems to me, overlook the probability of what appears to me a probability in any case, that behind China is Russia. It's interesting that this negotiation started with a statement by Malik in the United Nations that it didn't get really started in Korea until a meeting between Ambassador Kirk and Gromyko in Moscow had indicated that the road was clear and that actually there's a very grave possibility that what is being done now is that the Chinese are speaking for the Russians.
Well, you are assuming that that Mao is acting as perhaps blindly as a satellite of Stalin. Now, it's easy to see why Stalin might have had an interest in starting these hostilities in Korea, that it would pin down large American forces there. He is probably regards Chinese as expendable, and it might be very advantageous. On the other hand, one can see that if the main interest involved is that of Russia, that Stalin may have seen that a stage had been reached when he was going to lose prestige through the defeat of a satellite unless he gave it very large additional forces. And Stalin may very well have not wanted to commit large Russian forces to these hostilities. That might get him directly involved in the war and open his big cities to bombardment. And it also may be that he prefers to keep his major forces in Europe rather than in the Far East. So from that point of view, I can see why the Russians might very well, at the stage which had been reached, have thought that a ceasefire was desirable.
Well, I agree with Gottschalk, essentially. I believe that you certainly must look for the Russian behind the Chinese in this particular case. On the other hand, I think a survey of the internal conditions of China would help considerably to show why China herself might be interested, first of all, in a ceasefire, and secondly, in collaboration with the Russian program. I think the best information coming out of China these days, and the information is not very good at best, would show that China is going through a famine situation. Incidentally, historically, China has always been an importer of food, and since she has been cut off from the outside world, her access to food supplies has been more limited than ever. You have famine, you have flood, you have internal conditions, and it seems to me that this is putting the Chinese Communist government in a very serious situation, and one from which they must extract themselves by successes elsewhere.
Yes, I don't think that we know too much about what's going on in China, and I think that's very important, but I think what you have said about the possible rise of internal conditions resulting from famine, which appears to be widespread, which may jeopardize the internal stability of Mao's government, may be important. I should like to add to that the possibility that the Chinese, who are naturally individualists and localists, have felt that the central compulsion which has been put upon them by the Mao government, which seems to be more or less inherent in communism after it gets going, may have caused a great deal of unrest and restiveness among the masses of the Chinese people.
But if China and Russia are behind these negotiations, and it isn't merely a Korean question, then you've got to bear in mind that the Russians have sat down at negotiation tables with people from the West, representatives of the Western powers, on a number of different occasions, and nothing has resulted. I find it hard to forget also that on November 26th, 1950, the Chinese representatives arrived at the UN nation, at the United Nations, and on November 28th, 2 days later, the Chinese intervened unmistakably in the war. The possibility, therefore, that these negotiations are intended as a cover-up for something else exists.
Well, yes, there have been some cases where negotiations have failed, but the case which is most parallel to this seems to me the negotiation in regard to the Berlin blockade. That there you had a similar situation. Germany is divided, that is Korea. There it appeared that the Soviets reached a stage when they wanted to call the thing off, and a truce was made. The blockade was ended, the airlift was ended, and the status quo ante in regard to Berlin was restored. I think that's the best parallel.
Yes, well, I quite agree, but I think we ought to raise the other point, perhaps in connection with what we said earlier about the interests of the United States. It's conceivable to think of this thing, a truce arrangement, as not in the best interests of the United States. If we assume that Mao is going to move elsewhere, and I think we have very good reason to believe so, then it seems to me that we might argue, and quite reasonably, that continued pressure by the United States would keep China tied down in Korea so as to prevent her from moving southward, as I suspect she will do.
Well, it seems to me that goes a little against the argument you were just making about the famine and the serious internal conditions in China.
Yes, but...
Wouldn't that militate against her movement?
No, not at all. It seems to me that the movement southward will have two effects. One, it would put China down on the Bay of Bengal, for example, if they were able to take Burma. From a short-range point of view, this would give the communist government some kind of victory to point to, as in the case of Tibet. And in the long-range point of view, this would give China access to the one place in the Far East from which they could hope to derive rice in the future.
One of the things that you people have overlooked, it seems to me, is the history of this whole Korean question. It